Good afternoon, everybody, or good morning, depending on which part of the country you're in. Thanks for joining us. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm really excited to be moderating today's webinar on the new dynamic of healthcare collections when lawsuits might not be an option, which is being brought to us today by PDC Flow. In the past few months, healthcare organizations filing lawsuits to recover unpaid debts have been targeted for what some say are aggressive collection tactics. In response to these reports, a number of organizations across the country have altered their collection policies and strategies. In this webinar, we've got a panel of leading healthcare experts from across the credit collection industry who are here to talk about this new dynamic and what it means for healthcare collections going forward. As I mentioned, this webinar is being generously sponsored by PDC Flow. You'll get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick second and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Jay Gonzalez is president of Action Collection Agencies in Middleborough, Massachusetts. Action Collection Agency of Boston is a 51-year-old collection agency in ACA Revenue Systems. This is its first-party ARM company. The company serves healthcare providers in New England and nationally. Jay is a past president of ACA International and just concluded a term as a board member for the association. He's an ACA certified instructor and holds IFCCE and MCE designations, a bachelor's degree from UMass, and a master's degree in healthcare administration from Salve Regina College. Christian Lair is the chief operating officer of Healthcare Collections LLC, a third-party collection agency in Phoenix, Arizona. He is also the Arizona unit chair for ACA International and a former president of the Phoenix West Rotary Club. Having been involved in the industry for a number of years, I can say that Christian is one of the most knowledgeable and approachable individuals in the ARM industry, and looking forward to his participation today. Judd Peek is responsible for the creation, implementation, and continual oversight of the enterprise-wide compliance management system at the Frost Arnett Company. In this role, he ensures that the compliance program aligns with the overall corporate strategy, business plan, and code of ethics at Frost Arnett. Judd also oversees multiple compliance information tracking and monitoring systems. Prior to his role as chief compliance officer, Judd spent 16 years as an attorney in private practice, specializing in employee relations issues. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing and when the discussion is concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available later today on AccountsRecovery.net's webinar recordings page. Finally, I want to ask everybody to reserve a minute and fill out the feedback survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over. You'll also receive a link within the next 24 hours to access the survey. Your participation and your insights help me develop the content that's what you're looking for, such as the topic we have for you today, and the speakers you want to hear from, which is definitely the case with the people we have with us today. So with that, let's launch into our discussion, and let's go around the panel and maybe get a sense of whether or not you've noticed any changes with your healthcare clients as a result of all of the negative press that's been out there in the past few months. And Christian, since you're on my screen, why don't we go with you first?
All right. Well, thank you, Mike, and thanks for having me. In our market, we really have not had much luck convincing hospitals to sue in the past. The majority of our clients are nonprofits. We've asked them to consider that approach. We have a few who have taken it, and it has been very hesitant. And I will tell you, the ones that we continue to approach have said they really have no interest now. The recent spate of articles in the last 6 to 12 months have made them extremely hesitant to consider a legal approach to their outstanding accounts.
Excellent. Thanks. Judd?
Yeah, hi. Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Mike, at AccountsRecovery.net, and also thanks to PDC Flow for allowing me to be part of this today. And I will say, you know, yes, a simple question. The simple answer is yes, I've noticed changes. It's kind of been the last 6 months where we've had a lot of negative press regarding healthcare collections lawsuits, I haven't really seen a decrease in the number of lawsuits or an unwillingness from creditor providers to sue their patients or the consumers. But what I have seen is more attention from the providers on this issue. So that comes in a couple of ways. I've seen a lot of, extensions of vendor oversight. So more and more healthcare clients are taking a keen eye towards their outside collection agencies because of this, the negative press, and figuring out, maybe for the first time, what is it exactly that you do? What are your collection practices? What strategies do you employ? And really becoming involved, and you know, it's abandoning the old practice of just placing an account for outside collections and waiting for a check to come in or a payment to be posted. There's a lot more dialogue, I think, between providers and their outside agencies, and figuring out, you know, are we engaged in something through our agents that's potentially going to give us negative press or get us in trouble. And I think that's born a lot from healthcare providers. They're exceptionally worried about their reputation. Their reputational risk is key to them. And it's, you know, I think that's something that's peculiar to healthcare or medical collections. You know, these are creditors who have ongoing relationships with their consumers. So it's not just the matter of getting a car loan one time and then trying to get that paid off. These are patients that go to see their doctor for years, you know, maybe through their lifetime. And those relationships are critical to them, and they want to make sure that nothing that they do in order to get the revenue in necessarily adversely impacts that. So I think that's driving a lot of the attention from the providers on taking a new, keen, critical eye towards their outside collection agencies and just figuring out what they're doing. Especially on the litigation side. Are you suing for us? How often? What is the criteria for lawsuits and things like that?
Hey, Mike, it's Jay. I don't need to be prompted. Yep. I'm the last one, so I'll jump in now. And I'll echo my colleagues' gratitude and appreciation for the seminar, for PDFlow, and for those who've taken time out of their days to attend. It's a very timely and very critical topic. Here in New England, and I'm the oldest panelist here, so I go back a little ways to the point where I do remember when a lot of this first surfaced. And back in the late 80s or early 90s, Yale New Haven Hospital was cited for what became the term we use now for extraordinary, or they were called actually aggressive collection practices. And there were terms that were bandied about, such as body attachments and these bench warrants and things like that, that sort of cast the whole process in a very negative light. And we continue to see this today. If you were to review, as I did in preparing for this, because here in New England and in Massachusetts in particular, we don't do none of our hospitals go to litigation. We have some physician practices that do, but all of our hospitals don't. However, in my benchmark group, which I'm assuming those in attendance and on the call will understand, a lot of us have kind of coalesced with other agency owners and managers to form these benchmark groups, and we share a lot of things. My group in particular had agencies from all over the country. I was the only one in the Northeast initially. But a lot of my colleagues, and if you review the material that I mentioned, as I did when I was preparing for this, you'll see some articles about some of the agencies that operate maybe in the heartland of the country, particularly these smaller, and they're actually, and I know we'll talk about later the issue, the difference between the for-profits and not-for-profits and who's doing most of the litigation. I think it's surprising to find out who that is. But a lot of my colleagues that did this kind of work, and as Christian had indicated, he's trying to nudge his clients along, because I think done properly, it does benefit the clients, does benefit your liquidation rate also, because you know, in our case, and I would assume most of our cases, we do get credit for the liquidation that we do refer. We may not make much on them, if any, but we do get credit for it. So I think it's important in that regard, and if it's done well. But here in New England, we just don't do that much of it. But I think hospitals have had to look at across the board, as Judd pointed out, look at all aspects of their collection strategies, how they're deploying their resources, whether it's collection agencies or law firms. But I think how it's done, the communication, and hopefully we'll get to talk a little bit more about the communication between, the hospitals, the patients, and the collection agencies as well, because I view this whole process and accounts receivable management generally as a three-legged stool where there are responsibilities on all three parts, on the parts of the creditors, which in this case would be our hospital clients, the collection agencies that they engage, and the consumer, who is the patient. Everybody has responsibility here, most importantly, to communicate with each other, communicate about free care and a lot. If you read the material, there's been a lot of claims the hospitals didn't tell the patients these people would have qualified possibly for free care. There wasn't communication there. Sometimes there's not always communication across the board. So I think that's critical as well to kind of minimize the negative publicity and the noise surrounding these practices.
Excuse me. Awesome. Excellent. Good start. Thank you very much. Regardless of whether or not you're seeing or hearing of healthcare companies or hospitals that are going or filing more lawsuits, have you noticed any changes in the number of placements or the average amount of debt on new accounts? And this is something we're going to spend some time talking about throughout the day in terms of the high deductibles that may be causing some of the increase in lawsuits. I'm curious if any of you have noticed that you're seeing the debts that you're getting, if they're larger than what they've been in the past, and maybe this is one of the reasons why. Joe, would you mind going first this time?
Sure. No. Yeah. And definitely, over the last several years, that trend has gone up. So, the average balance definitely has increased over the last 5 to 10 years. And just as you mentioned, that's due to higher deductible health plans, more or higher copays, less insurance coverage, more exclusions, and just, the patient responsibility has gone from a very small amount to a very large amount. And that's, what I've seen with that, that's not directly tied to the recent negative press or publicity against hospitals. I think it's just a creature of the way the healthcare industry has gone. So placements have gone up, but at the same time, what I've seen from the healthcare providers, certainly the larger providers, health hospital systems and the like, there's been an increased reliance on vendor management companies. So, it used to be a very, close communicative relationship between some of the medical providers and the outside agencies. And what we've seen is this new middleman, so to speak, of healthcare providers have hired vendor management companies to manage all their vendors, including their outside collection agencies. And that's really become, I assume that there are certain efficiencies that they see in that relationship, but I've seen that trend become more and more prevalent, almost to where it's a standard business practice.
Judd, it's interesting you bring that up. At the ACA Fall Forum last week, Michael Ginsberg made a presentation, the M&A market and talking about what his company sees. One of the things he mentioned was what he called this middleware or whatever they call it with these vendor management companies. And it is important because I think those of us that have seen the development of this have also seen the challenge when you insert a third party between you and your client. As we all know, this is a very relationship-based business. I don't care how big your agency is or how big your health system is. Maybe not as much as it used to be, but it's still based on these relationships. And when you insulate or become insulated from those relationships directly with your clients, to some extent, it's a problem. One of the things that these companies do measure as they provide these scorecards and measure agency and both first party and third party companies, and they'll measure the performance. And a lot of what they're tracking too is differences between, true self-pay and balances after insurance. And as we know, the balances after insurance is what a lot of what we're getting now because of these health plans, which I think is a result. When managed care first came in, it was a lot different than it's become now, because you had like $3 copays and it was very, very different. But as the government tried to make them make them all things to all people, that exclusivity went away. So now healthcare providers aren't treating the really healthy young people. They're treating patients across the whole spectrum of healthcare. And that's why now you're seeing these very, very large copays and deductibles. And I remember when I first bought my company in the very early 90s, and Ginsberg actually mentioned this too during his presentation, was what was happening in the early 90s was kind of what we're seeing now nationally is this debate about healthcare and whether it's a right or a privilege, and that's ongoing. But at the time, there may be those on the call that remember Hillary Clinton was assigned the task of creating this new health system, and it, fortunately for a lot of us, it was kind of beaten back. But I remember colleagues around the country calling me, because here in Massachusetts, we did in fact, well, this was that was happening then, but then the thing continued to be an ongoing discussion. And then when Obamacare came in, I remember my colleagues around the country calling me, because if you recall, in Massachusetts, we had what was called Romney Care. In fact, it was a central point of the debates between Obama and Romney, because this was a Heritage Foundation, think tank kind of driven what we ended up with in Massachusetts. But a lot of agencies around the country would call me and say, "Hey, Jay, are you guys nervous? Are you going to go out of business because the government is going to pick? It's going to be like this Medicare for all kind of thing that we're hearing now." But as we know, that's not what happened. In fact, because there was still the private component to it, what happened was a lot of these deductibles here in Massachusetts, the copays and deductibles just ballooned. So we're seeing, in fact, in Massachusetts, just today, I got a notification that there's a bill introduced to cap the deductibles, which is an interesting thing, probably a whole other program about that, but between like $2,500 for individuals and $5,000 for family coverages. So we're seeing the recognition that this is an issue. And if you look at the average lawsuit that's filed by hospitals that do, it tends to be an average somewhere in the $2,000 range. So that seems to be the sweet spot that we're seeing. And a lot of it has to do with these increased deductibles and copays. So it's good for us, those of us that do this work on the first party and third party side, because absent any full public system without a private option, I think that we're always going to have a need for our services for our clients.
And if I could jump in, Jay, I think even with a full public option, you're going to see the need for third party, first and third party collection agencies. I can't imagine a system that would be put in place that would not have some level of either means testing or patient contributions that people are not going to pay. If we look at Medicare as it stands right now, we have a number of Medicare patients who have accounts referred to us for their yearly deductibles or their cost share portions or additional services that are not covered. So I really don't think any suggestion of the third party agencies going away because of whatever government plan is put into place, I just don't think that'll happen. And sort of going back to the question on the debts being placed, I don't know if this is the same in other states or if it varies based on what sort of Medicaid expansion the states did, but here in Arizona, at least, we found that the number of accounts went down, and I looked back going through 2010 to date, we saw about a 35% variance in the average size balance, but it actually peaked right around 2014, 2015, and it's been coming back down. And what we're finding is the number of accounts are going down because our nonprofit hospitals, and again, I'm speaking generally about hospitals, the physicians and the other groups tend to be different, but the nonprofit hospitals have had a much larger share of those outrageously large bills either get written off for charity or covered under Medicaid, what we call access here in Arizona. So we're seeing a reduction in those, and quite frankly, it's been beneficial for us because those were accounts that typically were not getting paid anyway. Giving us time to work on the accounts that, and when you talk about at an individual level, yes, the individuals who have balances after insurance, those have gone up. And the number of those have increased. But again, we've seen a tremendous offset from the charity write-offs, as well as the Medicaid expansion covering a lot more people who would have otherwise been sent to us in the past.
Okay, accidentally jump in here for a minute. And at this point, I wanted to just pause the discussion briefly for a moment and say a few words about the sponsor of today's webinar. That's PDC Flow. PDC Flow's payment hub offers a single platform for accounts receivable teams to quickly send an invoice, collect a credit, debit, or ACH payment, and obtain a signature in one simple and secure workflow. The software offers text, email, chat, and IVR payment channels, a customizable online payment portal, and robust reporting ideal for debt collection agencies, medical billing companies, hospitals, and healthcare organizations. Programming and customer operations for PDC Flow's national client base have been completed in-house in Ogden, Utah, since the company's founding in 2003. And again, I want to thank the team, especially Don and Hannah, and everybody at PDC Flow for sponsoring today's event. Now, let's pick up with our discussion. And what I'd like to do maybe is just as a reminder to everybody, if you have a question for our panelists, to type it into the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Let's take a question or two here that have been submitted. One thing that I wrote about earlier this week, the state of Connecticut has formed a task force to look into surprise medical bills and has formed a high deductible, what they call a high deductible task force. And I'm just curious, do any of the panelists worry that there will be government intervention on the legal process and other, ECAs. I'm going to assume that means external collection agencies, unless I'm
It's probably extraordinary collection attempts, activities.
There you go.
I'm thinking it's a 501R reference
okay.
for nonprofits.
Sorry, yeah, that makes more sense. Does anyone want to tackle that one?
I did mention here in Massachusetts, there is a bill that's been introduced that I mentioned as far as the deductibles, trying to cap them. So I think that probably does have some, is some attempt to address it. But I think in certain states, particularly in states such as mine, I know we may be talking about certain things. I think we were, there's some mention in our notes about say capping things like reducing things like the statute of limitations for healthcare debt. I did public testimony a few weeks ago here in Massachusetts because we have a number of pretty onerous anti-business bills here in the state. One of which is a robocall bill, but that's a separate issue. But we're dealing with that here, that's even more onerous than what we're looking at on the federal level. But there are a number of, it's just like what you're hearing nationally, forgiveness of student loan debt, some of those things. But the statute of limitations, there was an attempt to reduce it down to I believe 4 years. And which, as we know, those of us that do healthcare debt would be a problem, actually any kind of debt, but healthcare debt in particular, because there's a sort of an expansion of time sometimes before we even get an account placed with us. And then before we contact a patient and establish a repayment plan or whatever, we can be out there sometimes pretty close to that. And it's certainly if you get a payment plan in process. So that would cause this debt to be forgiven. So we in Massachusetts, we have a very activist attorney general, and a lot of this activity is being driven around the country, mostly by these attorneys generals who are very, very concerned about the increase in alleged increase in bankruptcy based on healthcare debt. So I think there's a heightened awareness about this nationally, but particularly certain states such as here, New York, California, Connecticut, I think we're seeing that kind of activity.
Well, I do think
I would see.
Go ahead, John.
Oh, that's fine. In addition to what Jay was mentioning, you know, I see or foresee a lot of state activities regarding just the litigation process on the part of patients or consumer debtors. I don't know what the percentage is, but the vast, vast majority of these collection lawsuits result in default judgments. I mean, these are consumers who have no knowledge of the court system or what they're supposed to do. They receive a summons or a general warrant in the mail, and they don't know how to respond to it, and they don't, and they get a default judgment. So it becomes really a garnishment or attachment issue with the judgment. I've heard a lot of scuttlebutt about state regulators and legislatures working on that side of it, to not just to educate consumers or patients on how to manage the court system, but actually to revise the court system to where there is an individual consumer advocate. Makes it easier. The process is very daunting for a non-lawyer to go in and deal with that. And as a result, I think a lot of people just decide not to, and they get these default judgments filed against them. So I think there's going to be a lot of room and a lot of movement on the part of the states to try to make that, for lack of a better term, more user-friendly.
I was going to say, it seems as though the federal level is very interested in this. At least when I see a staunch Republican, Senator Grassley, say that he wants answers from UVA, who had a news story I'm sure all of us saw, and is concerned about their tax-exempt status. In conversations with my hospital clients, that is a deep concern of theirs, that they are at risk of these types of investigations because of their tax-exempt status. And when you have a news story triggering a senator to take a personal interest in your health system, which obviously means he doesn't have a problem taking a personal interest in any of them, along with some of the bills that have been introduced to eliminate the surprise or the balance billing, which I think is also dramatically understood, the two sort of different ways that comes about. There is no sympathy for the hospital, for the health system, or certainly not for the debt collectors. So it's entirely one-sided coverage, and it gets attention, it gets eyeballs, and it gets votes if people say they're going to stop it. So I do think there's a real level of urgency and concern that we all should have when you see everything coming together to, you hate to say it, but handcuff the hospitals and physicians in terms of what they can and can't do to manage their receivables, money that is truly owed to them. And they're basically being told, well, you just can't go after it anymore, or we're going to make it so difficult and onerous and burdensome and shameful that you might want to reconsider even asking people to pay it. On the plus side, at the fall forum meeting, we had the CFPB there, and they spoke about their efforts to increase financial literacy education and to present information, seminars, topics, and web pages that would allow people to become more educated on their own financial literacy. And I think it speaks to what you talked about, Judd, there with the lawsuits, giving people some idea of what their responsibilities are, because I think we forget at some point there's some level of responsibility for the individual to at least address it, even if they can't take care of it, because there are a variety of means that the hospitals, health systems, and the collection agencies will work with people, but we need to speak with them about it. And just hoping it goes away is not a viable solution.
You know, Chris, that was the point that I was making earlier, and those on the call may remember ACA has, we've taken several passes actually at the whole issue. We have a foundation which supports consumer financial literacy, and for some of us who have been in leadership, I mean, we were launching these things, we were on TV and radio bit, mm-hmm. Trying to promote it, because the biggest thing, like I mentioned, that three-legged stool, communication is key, and we would always try to tell the patients, and I think that's a problem here, because if you read a lot of these news accounts of these cases, of course, they tried out the most horrific cases, and, we all, have compassion for people that are going through these things, but a lot of times, there's a common thread through this where the consumer will say, well, I didn't know until I started to see my wages garnished, or, my bank account was going down or whatever. But we all know that there's extensive effort on the part of hospitals to reach out to these, for the most part. I think generally, at least with our clients, we know what the financial counselors do and how much outreach there is. Then they're sent to collections, and there's effort there. So I find it hard to really believe that there's that much of a surprise by the time you get to that situation that's so dire at that point. So I think that that's critically important too. Several years ago, when we had the Washington fly-ins, we did meet with Senator Grassley, and as you say, it was kind of we were sort of taken aback, and we had some members who were in his state, and because we were trying to convey to him how critical, especially the community hospitals, where their profit margins are so slim that their tax status, there was talk of you know, withdrawing the tax status, and there was an effort to do that. So, you know, we tried to educate, because as we all know that they do operate on such thin margins. But if you read about this stuff, the percentages that they really get from their lawsuits and wage garnishment is a very, very small percentage. It makes me wonder, is it really even worth the effort because of the noise that comes with this? It just seems like there should be really another approach than this, because as we know, on the federal level, like you say, the CFPB, as well as the state level, they don't want what they call collection by litigation. They don't want the courts full of these bundled up. We see it with utilities do it. And it's I can see where it would be problematic and very, very, and very negative from a public relations standpoint when they have these consumers with such hardship cases being in that predicament.
You know, Jay, can I hijack the conversation for just a minute? Because you mentioned something that's one of my, it's almost a bane, and one of my main talking points, which when I see in this industry. So we've got the influx, the rise in consumer litigation, this collections litigation on one side, and that's causing all the negative publicity. But, you know, we for medical debt, we talk specifically about the rise in patient responsibility being one of the factors that goes into that. And I think that's true. But one of the other factors, and I think it's a significant one, is the pushback from regulators, consumer advocates, consumer attorneys on the communications channel. You talk about the communication between the debt collector and the consumer, or between the creditor and the patient. So, you know, we've had pushback on limits on phone calls, usage of the validation letter, TCPA lawsuits, call blocking initiatives, all these things that combined have really reduced the opportunities for a collector and a patient or any consumer to talk and resolve the account. So as those communication channels have been restricted, you know, what's left? You know, litigation used to be the collection method of last resort. I don't think it's becoming the last resort anymore, because we're truncating all these other opportunities to try to resolve a debt with consumers. If you can't reach a consumer who otherwise should be responsible for the account, if you can't reach the consumer on the telephone, via email, via letters, they're just unable to have that conversation. Litigation is the only thing that's left, other than just forgiving the account. So I think providers or creditors in general, they're dealing with both sides of this issue. You've got the increase in patient responsibility. At the same time, you're limited in your ability to try to resolve that pre-litigation, and that segment of the revenue cycle before litigation has really become shorter and harder to manage.
If litigation, you know, was or is or may not be the last resort anymore, what does that mean the new last resort is? Like, what are the, you know, sort of what are the options that a collection agency or a healthcare organization is going to have in terms of trying to collect on these debts?
Who's that question for?
Well, okay. I'll anybody and everybody.
I don't know that there's anything new that we would be doing. I think instead of it being last resort, it comes up a lot quicker. And I agree with you, Judd, completely, that there is a squeeze. We have people at the lower end who hopefully have been covered by an expansion of Medicaid in the state. We have people at the higher end who have the Cadillac health plans and the deductibles that have not gone up. And the squeeze is now on the middle class. The study that said, what was the number? The most people wouldn't be able to pay for an emergency over $400, a significant majority of U.S. citizens. And if you've got even a $1,000 deductible and a small cost share portion, 10 or 20%, although 20 is a little, not quite small, that is just a dollar amount that people don't have. Unfortunately for these people, they're the majority of the people, and a lot of them are working. So if you have someone you can't call, you can't email, you can't text, and you know they have a job, it's still the last resort, but it becomes the only option available to you to file that suit. And that becomes a larger number of the people that you're attempting to collect from that you can't talk to, you can't reach, they refuse to speak with you, or you run the risk of being sued if you speak to them in a technically incorrect manner. And that is what we are seeing at the physician side. Certainly, there has been an increase in interest in the physician groups to be more to become more aggressive with lawsuits, because they also realize that this is a group of people that are affecting their revenue more so than they had in the past.
Chris, I think I would agree with you, and I think it really almost becomes kind of a binary choice. And that's what we've been telling the regulators, that whether it's here in Massachusetts or in D.C., is that because of the restrictions, largely the discussion surrounding the TCPA, is that if we're unable to communicate in the way that, you know, let's even considering the way that the consumer wants to communicate with us, which undergirds really all of the conversations that we have, as you know, that we just had with the CFPB in Chicago, is that we want to communicate with the consumer the way they want to communicate with us, whatever way that is. And of course, now it's mostly all electronic. But if we can't do that, I don't think there is any other choice but to litigate, whether you do it yourself, whether you return it to the client for them to litigate it. So it's a lose-lose for everybody. We lose the revenue that we would otherwise get by working out a reasonable, prudent, appropriate repayment plans with consumers, bridging that gap that's developed between them and the creditor. All kinds of good things happen when people are able to communicate with each other in the way that they choose to. So I think that's a big issue, and I don't think it's going away. I think it's only going to get worse the more restrictions occur. The other point you made is also a good one in terms of who bears the cost of this. We're hearing a national debate right now on this Medicare for All discussion, which I think is now, even from the Democrat side, they're realizing that it's just a ludicrous, unsustainable program that cannot be funded. But if you think of it, the point you made is the same. On the lower side of the socioeconomic spectrum, you have the poor that generally, assuming they communicate, assuming they access the services that are available to them, they're going to be okay. The extremely wealthy are going to be okay too. They're going to put their money somewhere where it's safe, where it's safeguarded from this kind of stuff. But the burden is going to fall on the middle class. So much like this discussion we're having, unless there's a real outcry among Americans in the middle class that realize this burden is just going to crush them. One of the articles I read preparing for this talked about what used to happen in America, where you had civic organizations and churches and people would care for other people in their difficult times. That really doesn't happen anymore because the taxation is such that people figure that's not my problem, that's the government's problem. So we tend to look there as opposed to other places that we maybe historically did. So there are a lot of cultural issues going on here too. I've been in this business for probably longer than I have to count up, but it's been a while, over 30 years. And I remember when I first got in the business, as you recall, we had different, when you did collections, you had different appeals that you would use to consumer, one of which was sort of what we call the ethical or moral appeal, where what was right, the sense of right and wrong. We still use it, but like the goods or services, our services are rendered in good faith, and the payment wasn't obtained at the time of service for whatever reason, now it's up to the consumer to do the right thing, pay it. I think because of the degradation generally across a lot of that appeal doesn't work, and I think that we're seeing that affect everything in terms of this issue of personal responsibility and who's responsible for this bill. If you read, like in some of these articles, talks like the Southern Poverty Law Center is involved now. there. So they're demonizing hospitals, and they're demonizing the collection agencies that are just trying to kind of make this thing whole. So there's a lot of those political forces at play here that I don't think we can ignore completely, because they tend to drive policy.
I think that's true. We're talking about the future of litigation for these matters. I don't see, short of the country ever going to a single-payer system, I don't think that litigation, consumer litigation, will go away. I think it'll get revised and the practice will get refined and tweaked. And I really see a lot of that coming, not from the collection agencies. It's going to come from the creditors, the providers, and their input into that process, that part of the revenue cycle. It really, looking at criteria for lawsuits, looking at overall volumes, what their charity care policies are, and making sure those are implemented appropriately. It's going to be somewhat of a holistic approach. It's not going to get rid of litigation, but I think it will improve the instances of that. You don't want to be one of the providers that's been in the news lately that has filed, 8,000 lawsuits this year to date, or something that on paper looks really egregious. But that doesn't mean it's going to go away in total. I can't see that happening.
Well, a question I have for the two of you: would you agree that hospitals filing lawsuits is not just about generating the revenue, but about setting an expectation in the community that there will be a reckoning for some of the people who do not pay their bills? That it has some level of sort of public relations until they get the nasty story in the New York Times or the Washington Post?
So, Christian, that's interesting. We talked about providers and the negative reputational aspects of filing lawsuits, but you're wondering if there is actually a positive reputational benefit from that, from having a litigation strategy like that.
Well, I don't know if it's positive, but it's encouraging other people to pay their bills so they don't get a lawsuit.
It fits within it's strategic, I guess.
Sure.
In other words, I hadn't thought of that before. And it's not been a part of any conversation I've ever had with any of our clients or any providers or anything like that. But I think that's something worth chewing on. If you have an experience that kind of colors that question, I'd be interested to hear it. It's not something that has necessarily been communicated to me, but I think there's probably some merit to that in some aspect.
Well, if you think of it, Judge, it is actually kind of an interesting question, because I know when we talk to, say, new clients, for example, and they talk about, okay, so, when we place accounts, you have a minimum, balance that, and we all have our preferences, and we would all like to set a minimum balance, probably a little bit higher than maybe the clients would like. But if you think of it, what I tell our clients, I say, look, yeah, we'd like to have a minimum balance here. However, if you look at your fee schedule and you have a preponderance of, like, say, in your charge master, we have, like, say, you want to set a minimum of like $50, but you have this 48, 82, balance that shows up all the time because of your fee schedule, you don't want to not send that to collections for the very reason that Chris mentioned, is that it may send a message into the community that, look, at beyond this amount, it's a free service. Don't worry, you never have to pay it. Because as we know, that those of us who do work regionally, it doesn't take long before that word gets out. So I would say that dynamic could apply in this case too. However, when you talk about, it certainly isn't at least positive from a reputational standpoint, because I think it can still create some problems. But the other point I wanted to make, and what I had learned when I was kind of preparing for this, we tend to, at least the John Hopkins did a research for the Journal of American, of the American Medical Association in 2017, which is, I think, the last research that I could find. And they actually had an interesting statistic that said the for-profits used litigation for these purposes for 43% versus 33% of the not-for-profits, and I think 6% of government facilities did it. But I thought that was kind of telling. So from a reputation, you think the for-profits have that. I mean, those of us that do, we do both, naturally. You'd think that they would be more aggressive sometimes, maybe either the litigation in terms of this, maybe settlement authority that they may give you and different things like that. But I found that to be, and I don't know, those of you that do more of the lawsuits, do you find that with your clients? Is it, are the for-profits more apt to do it than the not-for-profits or vice versa?
I find that there are probably a higher incidence of not-for-profits that put a ban on suits. I do see that. As far as comparing for-profit and not-for-profit providers who authorize litigation, I don't see a lot of deviations between the two or some sort of bright line between them. I think it's that carve out of the ones that say, we're just not going to do that. That doesn't fit within our mission or the purpose or not-for-profit status. But, I'm interested in, the study that you mentioned. You know, for-profits and not-for-profit hospitals and provider groups often have different patient population pools. So they're drawing different demographics, different types of accounts, right. And right. That might drive a lot of the decision-making as far as what is an appropriate collection strategy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, Jay, our not-for-profit hospitals are the ones who tend to just have a blanket ban or lack of desire to have anyone file suits for them. So that's what we're seeing.
I mean, do you see any linkage between this and, for example, credit reporting? Because here, we don't have a lot of that with our hospitals either. We do a very large health system up here that is a for profit, and I just learned recently that they're looking at selling debt. Now we have some of our community hospitals and the not for profits that actually in their charter have that they will not sell debt, and that was a concern back in the maybe. In 2005 or six, we at ACA, some of us served on a committee because one of the problems that we had, and it was a lot of it surrounding the negative press concerning these aggressive, now they call the ECAs, but back then it was, the language was much more incendiary that they used to describe these practices. But our concern was that entering the market, the healthcare market, were the debt buyers. And our concern was that the debt buyers didn't quite understand what those of us like on this call that do healthcare debt primarily, that it's a very unique type of consumer debt and has to be treated in that way. But the debt buyers at the time were buying with these portfolios. They didn't really care. They'd either credit report them and then they'd just hammer them. And it was creating all kinds of problems. And we sort of became proactive on that. We formed a sort of a committee that was a commission, whatever we were called, task force, that was comprised of agencies, health systems and debt buyers. And we came up with at the time what we call the guiding principles for healthcare collections. And it talked about if you're going to do this kind of work, here are the kind of things you have to do contractually and in terms of with your providers and with the patients to really understand it. And I think that sort of tended to mitigate some of the concern that was going on because it really, you don't need to give the media or the regulators any more than they really need to kind of impact what we do. So I think it's important to be able to get up in front of some of these things, no matter where or when they're occurring.
Well, Jay, I think you've heard me say this quote from my dad, and I think it's still useful when you talk about medical debt versus other debts. He always says, none of the patients we deal with ever planned on overspending on their heart attack. This right. is not a debt that is, in most cases, voluntary or expected. And while we've got to keep that in mind, I do worry that the pendulum is swinging too far onto the side of people shouldn't be responsible for these debts at all. I think for the last 4 or 5 years, HFMA has been reporting on the decimation of the rural hospital, the number of rural hospitals that have been closing throughout the country, primarily because they can no longer sustain themselves in the environment that we're in. There is money that is owed to them by people who had services that can't afford it, and perhaps not all at once, or perhaps not all of it and only a portion of it. But I think we need to be vigilant, as you said, to keep the reasons for the regulators and the press to excoriate us to a minimum. But we have to continue to work to convince people that this money is necessary in order to maintain hospitals and health systems throughout the country. It can't just go away and have them continue to operate as though nothing has changed.
Right. I mean, is there anyone among us, and Judd, you're the biggest firm of the three of us, that I used to even say this, of course, now I'm much further along in my career, but I remember back then I would tell clients that we have repayment plans. I will long since be retired before this thing, assuming it doesn't break, is ever paid off. And that's what we do. I mean, all of us, we assuming our clients allow us to, but we do it because we don't want to create the noise for them. You know, we don't want, like up here in New England, I don't want the Boston Globe to get this and write about this horrible collection agency that this horrible hospital is using on these poor defenseless patients. And I think we all go above and beyond. We go above, in our code of ethics, we all go above and beyond from a validation standpoint. We give patients, we give consumers much more than we're required to do under FDCPA. Number one, because obviously that's how we're probably going to get paid. But also, it's just kind of the right thing to do. And we have a similar thing here. When I bought my company, the gentleman who owned it before me, he had an expression that we still adhere to now, is that we treat every patient the way we would want our family members treated. And we got, you know, because we're all in the same, everybody, my old staff, and we were all in the same boat. We all get it. We understand how challenging things are, you know, economically, even though the things have improved now, but there are still people that aren't really feeling this, the good times like some are. So I think we have to be, and a lot of us, I talk to agencies in my role in ACA over the years, all around the country. I've been to agencies. I'm so impressed with our industry and how we treat patients, how we treat each other, that I think that we're often given a really bad rap generally. And I think that all of us go to great extents to not that.
Yeah, I like how you're waxing philosophical a little bit. I dig that. But I think that's true. Healthcare and medical debt collections, it's different because of what, Chris, what you mentioned about, you know, these aren't debts that arise because of poor spending habits. This is, you know, they're not blowing money on bubblegum and comic books and racking up consumer debt. This is completely different. This is unpredictable. This is due to, you know, catastrophic instances in patients' lives. And we need to be cognizant of that and treat them with the respect and dignity they deserve accordingly. And Jay, to your point, you know, that's exactly right. You know, we need to, we certainly make a value import on that relationship. I don't want us as an outside collection agency to be the source of a degradation in that patient provider relationship.
Right.
I don't want to be the cause of that. And I certainly don't want to be blamed for that. And we need to understand we're agents of our clients. We're agents of the providers. And if the relationship and the community reputation is important to them, which it is, then we need to adhere to those principles.
Right.
So how do you do that and still collect, at, you know, and still sort of persuade people to make payments at the same time?
Yeah. How do you do that in the new normal where we have all these outside influences, you know, the negative press on litigation, the pushback on consumer communications?
Right. If you're lucky enough to get somebody on the phone, if you're lucky enough to get someone on the phone, they're like, what are you going to do? You're not going to report it to the credit bureau. You're not going to sue me for it. Why should I repay it?
You know, like, well, I mentioned earlier, you know, over the last, you know, maybe this last generation, perhaps, we've seen, I think there's been somewhat of a reluctance to, that's why I said the appealing to sometimes the morality isn't always what it was. But I still think it does have merit. And I still think that human nature being what it is, I don't think we have a lot of options. So I think in your collection technique, I think you still have to deploy those kind of you know, timeless principles of assuming, like I think both Judd and Chris have said, that, you know, people don't intend to have a cardiac episode or a car accident or different things like that. Their portion is, their responsibility is much greater than it once was. How are we going to work that out? And I think if we generally approach everything as if they want to work it out, I think that's a good place to start. You may get to that other place eventually, and maybe more so our liquidation rates aren't what they used to be. We know that. But I think that we can still approach the business the way I think we're supposed to, and I think we generally come out better on the other end.
Yeah, I think while we're speaking with fewer people, and I agree with you, Jay, the liquidation rates aren't what they used to be. But we're still speaking to people in the same way.
Nor are the contingency rates.
By far. We still speak to them the same way we always did. And I find the ones that do communicate with us do feel that sense of obligation. They understand that the hospital, the physician, even the anesthesiologist, which is a whole other issue when it comes to billing, they provided a service. They helped either save their life or help with their health. And they do want to pay it. They can't. And I think the standard collection techniques of helping people find a way to find the money to pay that, whether it's all at once or in payments, there is still a desire. I'm very impressed with a lot of patients that we are able to speak with because they do feel that obligation on the medical debts. They're just in a position where they can't figure out how to do it. Again, that goes back to the whole financial literacy, the lack of savings. They're in a hole, and if we can get them on the phone or email or text and help them work through it, I think it's better for everyone. And that's why it's so unnerving to see the attempts to eliminate the communication between us and patients, and not why the legislators and the attorneys general don't expect that there'll be some other way that we'll try to get that money is beyond me. I can't imagine that they're that blind to the unintended consequences.
If we're looking at litigation against patients specifically, I think there's going to be I think it's already started, but it's going to be a necessity to really refine that strategic approach to it. It's no longer going to be, well, we have an aged account, the balance is X, which is good enough for us, we have verified employment, ergo, we're going to sue this account. I think that's not going to be the correct strategy or the successful strategy going forward. Chris, earlier you mentioned about how the problem with middle class not being able to afford their copays and their deductibles anymore. I think that's true. We need to really, as outside agencies and providers together, look at what are our standards for litigation and really refine that and implement it. The easy formula, X plus Y equals Z, isn't going to be the way we can do it anymore. I think it's going to be a much more sophisticated approach, but that doesn't mean litigation is going by the wayside. I think it just means we're going to have to take more particular attention to it.
Absolutely. And to be clear, it's not the desired path, I think, of anybody in our industry, except perhaps attorneys. And even them, I don't think they want to see more litigation because it's required because you're unable to communicate with people otherwise. I think attorneys, when they're looking at this, would prefer to be able to speak to the person first as well. So again, just to clarify, I don't want to see that happen. I don't want to see more litigation. But as you continue to limit the ability to attempt to collect using other means or the means we've used over the past 51 years in Jay's case, company's case, 27 for us, you have to do something. The option isn't there to just ignore the debts.
Well, I think the thing too is if we could maybe sort of pivot a little bit, be a little more creative, and maybe we look at more settlements. Maybe we try to discuss this with our clients. And of course, they all have different, whether they are charters and credit collection policies that may or may not preclude them. But I think that's another good option is that we have, as we know, it's an easier sell with patients sometimes is to try to work something out like that might be more, they might be more amenable to. So I think that's another possibility to not have to go to the extremes of litigation.
Well, even at that, we've had some clients have been hesitant to either reconsider or look at settlements because they fear they'll run afoul of the financial assistance policies they've already put in place.
Yep.
So they're hindered by actions outside of their control. And, it's just, when you put, regardless of what the restrictions are, but when you put all of these restrictions, you have to understand that's going to have an effect in places you didn't expect.
Right.
Excellent. Well, on that note, we've reached the top of the hour, which means we've run out of time. I apologize if we didn't get to as many of the questions from the audience. I apologize if we didn't, but I thought the conversation between Judd and Jay and Christian was really interesting and insightful, and didn't want to interrupt. So I do apologize for that. But before I let everybody go, I want to thank Jay, Christian, and Judd for their insights and their time today. You are all exceedingly insightful and willing to share. And on behalf of everybody, thank you very much. This was a great conversation. I also want to thank PDC Flow one last time for sponsoring today's webinar. I really appreciate their continued support. Thanks to everybody who listened. A final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey to share any ideas or topics or speakers that would be of the best use to you, or the information you're looking to learn, or any specific pain point you'd like to see addressed. That's the best way to try and to get that information to me. And I hope everyone stays tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Panel, awesome job. This was great. You guys rocked it.
Thanks so much.
And thanks, everybody else. Have a great day. Have a great weekend. Thank you very much. Take care.